Good morning, family. If you would, please open your Bibles to the New Testament book of Hebrews. Hebrews, the first chapter. Back in the early 1800s, the United States and the British Empire were in something of a tug of war over the Pacific Northwest. Now, the British had been there prior to us. Their explorers, their fur traders had gotten there first. But there was something of a quibble as to how much of the Pacific Northwest was part of Thomas Jefferson's Louisiana Purchase. Now, one way the United States thought of to tip the balance in our favor was to encourage Americans to immigrate to the Oregon Territory. And no place caught Oregon fever more than the people living in Missouri. In fact, the very first wagon train for Oregon was organized by a merchant who lived just over in Weston, a little bit west of here. Peter Burnett was an aspiring lawyer, struggling merchant, and just at the time, a member of the Churches of Christ. He had a wife who was very sick. He had six children. And in 1842, he had over $15,000 in debt, a significant sum. For that reason, the prospect of 1,600 free acres in Oregon held some appeal to him. So he started talking up putting together a wagon train to go there in 1843. Now, one of the people who heard Burnett give one of his promotional speeches summarized his words as follows. He told of the great crops of wheat which it is possible to raise in Oregon, and pictured in glowing terms the richness of the soil and the attraction of the climate, and then, with a twinkle of humor in his eye, he said, "And they do say, gentlemen, they do say that out in Oregon the pigs are running about underneath the great acorn trees, round and fat and already cooked, with knives and forks already sticking in them so that you can cut off a slice whenever you're hungry." Now, to many American settlers, the Pacific Northwest was the promised land. A lot of the literature of the period would describe it in that term, promised land flowing with milk and honey. So they would set off on the 5-month, 2,000-mile trek, daydreaming of how much better life would be for them in Oregon. The truth is, not all who started out to Oregon with high hope made it. The of the trail soon dampened enthusiasm, disease, deprivation, torrential rain, blistering heat, flooded rivers, long stretches with no drinking water whatsoever, the death of loved ones through accidents, soon choked off the daydreaming with the cold hand of reality. These difficulties of the trail caused a number of families to turn back at various points in the journey for the comfort of the familiar, rather than to endure the hardships of the unknown. The Christians addressed by the writer of Hebrews were at a similar tipping point. The nature of the book suggests that they were Jews who had converted to Christianity some time back. For in the 5th chapter, verse 12, the writer actually chides his readers that by this time in their spiritual journey, many of them should have been teachers. So they've been in the faith for a while. But it appears that following Christ was not as they had imagined it would be. And it was getting very difficult. It appears that they were on the brink of giving up their journey and returning to the familiar, the tried and true faith of their ancestors. Perhaps that's why the inspired writer said such things to them as, Let us run with endurance the race set before us. Chapter 12 and verse 1. He told them to think about what Jesus went through so that you may not grow weary and faint-hearted. 12 verse 3. He may have even tried to shame them into not turning back by saying, you've not yet resisted to the point of shedding your blood. 12 verse 4. Now, if this document was written in the early to mid-60s A.D., as I believe it was, I can understand the appeal to return to Judaism. The first generation of Christians was dying off. Likely almost all the apostles had been killed. Society at large was in a state of chaos. The economy of the Roman Empire in which they lived had tanked. The empire was bankrupt. Civil war had broken out. Various provinces were trying to break away and become independent kingdoms. It looked like the empire was coming apart at the seams. And Jews back in Palestine had begun to revolt. They had actually won the initial battles against the Roman Empire, and it looked like the Jewish homeland would be free once again. At such times of uncertainty, family, what do people do? When all around us is chaos, do we not look for an island of stability in the midst of the storm? Now, where would that be for a pious Jew? What's the one thing in the life of a pious Jew and the Jewish people that had remained relatively constant over thousands of years? That would be their faith and the faith of their ancestors. A source of pride among the Jews was the antiquity of their nation and their religion. In fact, a Jewish priest from the late first century wrote a defense of the Jewish people after the Romans had conquered them yet again and destroyed the temple. And this Jewish priest named Josephus titled his defense of the Jewish faith, "The Antiquity of the Jews." He pointed out that as a people and as a religious system, they had been around a whole lot longer than the Romans and the Greeks. So I can see the appeal of a faith that had survived 2,000 years of invasions and conquest. One aspect of the Jewish faith that they were particularly proud of was their prophets, God's mouthpieces. Noting Josephus again, he boasted that the Jews were at least the equals, if not the better, of the ancient Egyptians and Babylonians, two of the oldest empires on the planet. He said that the Jews were as good as them, if not better, in keeping records of their history. In a letter against an opponent named Apion, he said, "As to our forefathers, they took no less care than the Egyptians and the Babylonians about writing such records. They committed the matter to their high priests and the prophets. And these records have been written down all along to our own time with the utmost accuracy." And a little later in that same letter, he said that the reason their records were so perfect, so complete, was that the prophets to whom they had been entrusted were inspired of God. Now, it's not that other people, groups, other religions didn't have prophets. They did. But to the Jews, they rightly believed that those other prophets served false gods, not the real God. And they rightly believed that none of the other culture's prophets could hold a candle to the likes of Abraham and Moses, Elijah and Elisha, Isaiah and Jeremiah and all the others. In fact, the Jews' pride in their prophets could be seen in the way that they had built elaborate tombs and monuments to their memories. And they did this roughly about the first century, even though the prophets had been dead for hundreds of years. Jesus actually scolded the Jewish leaders on this point. In Matthew 23:29-30, he said, "Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites! For you build the tombs of the prophets and decorate the monuments of the righteous, saying, 'If we had lived in the days of our fathers, we would not have taken part with them in shedding the blood of the prophets.'" Now there's an irony for you. They greatly admired their prophets once they killed them. But while they were alive, not so much. Interestingly, the way the writer of Hebrews opens his sermon is to put the Israelite prophet in their proper place. Now, it's not that the prophets of old didn't have a part to play in God's plan of salvation, but Christians have something far better. Hebrews chapter 1, the first verse. Long ago, at many times and in many ways, God spoke to our fathers by the prophets. But in these last days, He has spoken to us by His Son, whom He appointed heir of all things, through whom also He created the world. He is the radiance of the glory of God and the exact imprint of His nature, and He upholds the universe by the word of His power. After making purification for sins, He sat down at the right hand of the Majesty on high. There is both continuity and contrast in what is said here. The continuity that we shouldn't miss is that God has always spoken to His people. Long ago and in these last days. But from the perspective of the writer of Hebrews and his first readers, there's a contrast between the mouthpieces of long ago and the communicator in these last days, the age of the Messiah. Let's use the remaining time we have this morning to look at some of these contrasts, because it pretty much sets the theme for the rest of this book. Now, the revelation of God this passage seems to be talking about is not so much the doling out of religious practices and beliefs, as it were. More so, it's about the self-revelation of the nature of God, who He is, and what He's like. In that regard, the prophets of old caught only glimpses of God, for no human could see God in all His glory and live. If you'll recall from the book of Exodus, the 33rd chapter, when the prophet Moses asked to see God's glory, God told Moses he would not survive such an encounter. So God sheltered Moses in the cleft of a rock and blocked Moses' line of sight, so that he could only catch a at God's good. Jesus, on the other hand, is the only full disclosure of God, the only one who knows God completely, and the only one who can reveal God fully. Speaking of Jesus in the Gospel of John, the first chapter in verse 18, we read, "No one has ever seen God. The only God who is at the Father's side, He has made Him known." That's because Jesus and the Father are one, according to John 10, verse 30. Again, in the Gospel of John, the 14th chapter, beginning in verse 6, Jesus told His disciples, "I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father except through Me. If you had known Me, you would have known My Father also. For from now on you do know Him and have seen Him." Philip said to Him, "Lord, show us the Father, and that'll be enough for us." Jesus said to him, "Have I been with you for so long and you still don't know me, Philip? Whoever has seen me has seen the Father. How can you say, 'Show us the Father'? Do you not believe that I am in the Father and the Father is in me? The words that I say to you, I do not speak of my own authority, but the Father who dwells in me does his work. Believe me that I am in the Father and the Father is in me, or else believe on account of the works themselves." Now what Jesus says here could not have been said of any of the Israelite prophets. Now here in Hebrews 1, among the other things that set God's self-revelation in Jesus Christ apart from God's glimpses of Himself shown to the prophets, is that Jesus is, as the Son, the heir of all things. Meaning, He's the rightful owner of everything. He owns the universe. Could that be said of Isaiah, even though he was a great prophet? Just as Jesus is the heir and the owner, we're also told here in Hebrews 1 that He is the one through whom God created the world. Something of an unfortunate rendering, because here the author didn't use the normal Greek word for world or universe, not the one for the planet. That's cosmos. He used the word for epoch. For ages. I own. Each prophet lived a limited lifetime on a small corner of a small planet in the vast sea of the universe. But Christ, as the creator of the ages, that's what it says. He's the creator of the ages. And as the creator of the ages, He spans the epoch. He rules time. That can't be said of the great prophet Elijah. As we continue reading in Hebrews 1, we see that Christ is the radiance of the glory of God. And just as one cannot separate the brightness of the light from the light itself, one cannot separate seeing the Son from witnessing the presence of God. Since the Son manifests the person of God, the glory of God that Moses wanted to see but couldn't is found in its entirety in the person of Jesus Christ. If you would see God's glory, He's telling His listeners, look to Jesus, not to Moses, who had to hide the presence of God. Jesus is also the exact imprint of the Father's nature. This terminology is used for distinguishing the characteristics and the identifying mark that makes someone who they uniquely are, or simply what it is. What is it that makes you, you? If someone were going to describe you to another person who's never seen you, and not just describe how you look, but describe your personality and character, what would they draw upon to describe you so that when this other person met you, they, okay, yeah, that's them. What is it that makes you, you? What qualities, what characteristics? That's what this is talking about. He has all the qualities and characteristics that make God. In Jesus Christ, there is the perfect visible expression of the reality of God in Christ. People see in human form the love and the mercy and the justice and the holiness and the goodness of God. If you want to know what God looks like, if you want to know who God is and what God is like, Look to Jesus. As he told Philip, if you've seen, you've seen the Father. Do you hear about God being love? Well, you want to know what God's love looks like? Jesus. Do you hear about God being merciful? Do you want to know what God's mercy looks like? Look at Jesus. None of them could be the person of Jesus Christ. The exact nature of God comes fully into focus. You couldn't say that of the prophet Ezekiel. Unlike any prophet, Jesus upholds the universe by the word of His power. This means that Christ is actively governing both the visible and the invisible realms, guiding events to unfold according to His purposes. He's running the show. Elisha couldn't do that. I think of prophets like kayakers navigating a portion of the river. They're pretty much pushed along by the current. While they're trying to stay afloat and get to a certain point, the truth is the river controls them more than they control the river. Christ, however, doesn't just ride the river. Nor is he whipped along by the current. Unlike the prophet, he made the river. And he controlled the river. Time and matter are bent to his purposes rather than being the forces that he simply attempts to navigate. Can you see? Finally, we read here in Hebrews 1 that only Christ could make purification. The Old Covenant prophets often called attention to and rebuked the Israelites for their sins. That was part of their job. Yet though they could point out the sins in the life of the people, they could do nothing to purify those people from their sin. In that respect, prophets kind of function like an MRI or a CAT scan. They could identify the tumor, but they could do nothing to remove it. Jesus, on the other hand, could not only identify sin fully for what it is and what it does, but because of His pure and untainted nature, was able to purify us from all sin through His death on the cross. Just as Jesus was killed by the Jewish and Roman authorities, we've already seen that many of Israelites' prophets were killed by the people they were sent to help. The death of Isaiah did not and could remove this. The opening paragraph of Hebrews makes it clear from the outset that no better place to turn in the midst of life's trials than to the Son who owns it all, made it all, rules it all, and cleanses us from all sin. Why would you want to turn away from that to something lesser? God communicated through many prophets over the centuries. So much remained unsaid. When Jesus came, God fully expressed His heart, His mind, and His will. So again, who in their right mind would turn back from the Son to rely on the servant Are we much different than the first readers of Hebrews? Aren't we tempted at times to just give up? Turn back? Something else? I mean, there are many times when we encounter trials in our lives, yes? Sometimes it seems that most of the river we're on is rapids with just tiny stretches of smooth water, right? Now, it may be that in those trials, you're not tempted to turn your back on Christ. Maybe. But I'm sure you know someone who did, don't you? Looking back over your life, can you not bring to mind at least one brother or sister in Christ? Isn't anymore. Because they turned back from the Lord. More than likely, it's someone whom you would never have expected to do. How many of us have known someone we were inspired by, we were motivated by, we looked up to, we respected, and we saw as a strong Christian? And then one day, in the midst of their trials and struggles, they decided following Christ wasn't worth it and walked away. Was that not a shock to you? Family, I can promise you, even though it's completely out of my control, I can promise that we're each going to have trials, plural. And we're each going to struggle seasons in our lives with doubt. But I ask, what sense is there in turning away from the Son who owns it all, made it all, and rules it all, and cleanses us from all our sins, and turn to someone or something who can't do any of that? What sense is there in that? I mean, look at the way people look to government to solve the problem. Don't we? You know what governments are made of? People like you and me who are sinners. You really think they can fix things? You really think they can fix what's wrong with this planet? Or we'll turn to money. So if I, yeah, I could just have 1.367 billion, all my problems go away. How many of us turn to Tylenol, ibuprofen, fix our pains more often than we turn to God in prayer? You know, it's interesting that one of the things that made the first wagon train to Oregon more successful than most follow, even though no one in that, I mean, they were blazing the trail. There were no roads. They had to cut roads over the mountains. They had to cut down forests to get their wagons through. They were the trailblazer. They made the trails that the other followed. So in many ways, they had more hardships than the other. But one of the primary reasons they succeeded where so many others did not is that before they left what we call Nebraska today, a man by the name of Marcus Whitman caught up the train. Marcus Whitman was a missionary who serves today Eastern Washington. He had been down the trail before. He'd gone, he had come back to talk to his mission sponsors, and then was headed back to the mission, and he caught up with the train. Medical doctor, and someone who had already been where they were going. And his services and his advice were indispensable to the success of that journey. In that sense, Marcus Whitman was echo of who we have on our. You and I have never been to heaven, never seen what it's like. We're told it's a pretty nice place, right? And so we're hoping to get there. We're on a journey. Do you know who we have as a guide? He's already been there, family. Jesus Christ. And He came down here. Show us how to get there. And not simply show us, you know, go this way, go that way. To help us along the way. To walk with us along the way. To minister to us along the way. So why give up? Family, from the very outset, the message of the book of Hebrews to us is to keep the faith. Don't give up. Stay focus on the one who owns it all, made it all, rules it all, and delivers you from your sin. Don't rely on yourself. And don't look to some human. How many of you have been disappointed in your spiritual journey by a preacher? By an elder, by a deacon, from some other person you thought was a giant of the faith, and then they disappointed. Why should you be shocked? Why should you be shocked that a sinner like you would disappoint? You don't tie your wagon to them. You don't hitch your wagon to another human being. Hitch your wagon to Jesus Christ and none other. He's not going to fail you. He's not going to disappoint you. He's the one we need to look to, the author and perfecter of our faith. So it makes no sense to turn back to someone or something that in the end cannot save. Keep the faith. Look. Family, we come to a time in our service when we extend the opportunity to share. While we don't want to look to individuals to, you know, kind of hitch ourselves to in the living out of our faith, we do look to each other for help. I mean, the reason they organized these wagon trains, because they thought there was strength in number. Resources in number. They were there to help each other out, and that's what we're here to do. In a moment, we're going to stand and sing. And we encourage you, if you have something you're struggling with, one of the trials you're going through, or if you want to know more about the one who owns it all, made it all, rules it all, and delivers you from your sin, and you want to know how to come into a saving relationship with Him. We'd be happy to share that with you. We would just open up the Bible, tell you how to come into that saving. If you have any need, we invite you to make it known. We're going to stand, we're going to sing. You can either come down here in front and one of our shepherds will visit with you, pray with you, share what you want shared with the congregation. Or if this is just a little too big for you, then as we stand and sing, head out these back doors, go all the way down the hallway, hook left.
Great is the Lord, He is holy and just, by His power we trust in His love. Great is the Lord, He is faithful and true, by His mercy He proves He is love. Great is the Lord and worthy of glory, great is the Lord and worthy of praise. Great is the Lord, now lift up your voice, now lift up your voice. Great is the Lord, great is the Lord. Great is the Lord, He is holy and just, by His power we trust in His love. Great is the Lord, He is faithful and true, by His mercy He proves He is love. Great are You, Lord, and worthy of glory. Great are You, Lord, and worthy of praise. Great are You, Lord, I lift up my voice, I lift up my voice. Great are You, Lord. Great are You, Lord.
First of all, I briefly want to mention, it was on the crawl, it's in the bulletin, but we're a little late getting the word out. Next Sunday is fifth Sunday. We will have a fellowship meal after Bible class, so if you can, plan to attend that. And also as fifth Sunday evening will be the area-wide meeting. Not sure yet where it's going to be. But plan on that if you can, and there will not be services here.